IRA, environnement, is the online media based in Comoros Islands with a radio of environmental education launched in 2020 with the support of UNESCO. Listen to Your Voice, the Sustainable Development Podcast, introduced by Radio IRA Environnement.
This is Radio IRA Environnement, the radio of environmental education. You are listening to the podcast.
Understand Sustainable Development Goals 1. No poverty. 15. Life on land. 10. Reduced inequalities. 13. Climate action with Edouard Bobier.
Good afternoon, Radio IRA Environment. Welcome, Edouard Bobier, a university distinguished professor in the Department of Economics at the Colorado State University. He is an expert on environmental and resource economics as well as international environmental policy. Good afternoon, Mr. Bobier.
Good afternoon.
You will be part of the Global Forest Summit held in Brussels, Belgium. What are your expectations?
Well, I'm hoping that what comes out of the summit is a coherent understanding of the problems of managing forests in the modern economy, and also, more positively, the strategy that we can take to improve management of the forests, including conservation, restoration, and also investing in the people that use the forests.
Okay. The agreement in Glasgow, the Glasgow Climate Pact on Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, is not clear enough to stop companies bending the rules according to civil society. The global indigenous communities call nature-based solutions nature-based dispossessions. They even said recently that the same companies taking out offsets is the same cooperation destroying nature. What do you think of the nature-based solutions?
Well, I think nature-based solutions are a hopeful strategy, but it's all in the devil is all in the details in how we implement them. And there is indeed concern that if we don't manage nature-based solutions correctly, then essentially we could end up paying those who have already destroyed the environment to turn around and protect them. The classic kind of paying the poachers to be gamekeepers problem. And one of the things we need to do is understand that we have to also get our policies correct. It's not just about investing in nature, but it's also about dealing with the underpricing of nature. What I mean by that is that in many of our policy, market, and business decisions, we give nature a zero price, or even more, we actually give it a negative price because we actually pay companies and individuals to destroy the environment through subsidies that are environmentally harmful. And what I mean by that is agricultural subsidies that lead to more land conversion, soil erosion, and pollution runoff. Forest subsidies that encourage more taking out of old growth forests rather than conserving them, subsidies to expand agriculture, aquaculture in coastal areas at the expense of mangroves and wetlands. These are the type of policies that need to be stopped if we're going to also invest in nature. Because as long as companies and individuals have incentives to either ignore the environment or to actually destroy it through these subsidies, then no amount of money can be put in to invest and compensate by restoration through just investment alone. We have to get the incentives right, which means getting the policies correct.
Getting the policy correct, but also how about the communities? How about the communities if they are not involved? In Gabon, for instance, there is a big issues related to this. There is no transparency. How can you integrate the communities in this process?
I think that's an absolutely essential part of the solution also. For one, much of our forests are actually under customary or community-based tenure of some form. And the first problem is often those customary or traditional rights are not recognized in our formal laws, institutions, and governments. In other words, governments and businesses ignore the wishes of the communities and how they've been using forests, often sustainably, for generations. And we need to understand that that first of all, we have to start with respecting and taking into account the indigenous community and also wider community rights and access to the forests, and to make sure that those rights and access lead to sustainable use, and that those have precedence over giving away our forests to large-scale commercial concessions or to individuals who want to speculate in future values of commercial products. So that starts with community recognition of community rights. The second part is ensuring that communities have a say in the management of the resources going forward. By that I mean that if, for example, we invest in nature-based solutions that lead to restoration, we should have the communities that benefit from the restoration should have a say in the management of the forests that are restored or rehabilitated going forward. And I think until we start to do this bottom-up approach to managing our forests and our other forms of nature, we're going to always have this conflict between commercial interests and community and local interests.
And how about the meaning of co-benefit? What does that mean exactly, co-benefit?
Co-benefits means that that there is a principal benefit for doing something. So, for example, investing in restoring forests in order to store more carbon would be a principal benefit, but the co-benefit would be the additional benefits that might happen to the environment and indeed to society. So, for example, if you have a project that restores forests and that project involves hiring local people to do the replanting and to manage it, that's a co-benefit. You have increased employment and you've increased the livelihoods of local people. And another co-benefit of nature-based solutions is, of course, by growing more forests, you're also bringing back habitats and other ecosystem services that may also be beneficial to local people. More wild resources to collect or to harvest, and more protection of fields and agriculture through watershed services might be some of the co-benefits of restoring forests and watersheds.
I see. How do you see the local knowledge, the traditional knowledge? How do you integrate this?
Traditional knowledge is incredibly important. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, many of the local communities, particularly the indigenous communities, have traditionally used the forests for a whole variety of things, from medicines to local goods to foods, and for commercial, their own small-scale commercial uses to bring in cash income. And that traditional knowledge comes with a whole understanding of how the system, the ecosystem works, and how it might function better if it was restored in a certain way. And that traditional knowledge can be useful for both restoration and also for conservation. It's also been used around the world, traditional knowledge, to understand further what are some of the key important medical and other benefits of forest products. And this is incredibly important for developing new medicines and also for new products that could come back and benefit local communities as well as provide cash for managing forests.
Can you give me an example?
From Costa Rica, which mm-hmm. is even better because most of our forests that we need to protect are tropical forests. And Costa Rica has tropical forests, and it has had a long-term program of paying local people, involving local people in helping scientists discover what are the medicinal and other health benefits what are the medical properties of the plant chemicals of species in the tropical forest in the Guanacaste protected area, for example, and that in turn has led to contracts with companies to actually have access to those chemicals in order to use them to develop new drugs, medicines, and so forth. And those payments go back to protecting both the protected area and also to benefit local communities from the income.
Climate finance is still an issue for Africa and for developing countries. Little goes to adaptation in Africa, for instance. What kind of solutions that developed countries should bring on the table?
Well, I certainly feel that the first instance is that developed countries, advanced economies, should honor their pledges and commitments to what they have promised in terms of adaptation climate financing, which goes back to the Paris Agreement in 2015. So we should continue to make that commitment. The second thing that we should do is to think more carefully about what we mean by adaptation and where it plays with mitigation. So what does restoration of forests, how does that fit in? Is that part of the adaptation, part of the mitigation, or both? We shouldn't just say adaptation is about funding people to move away from climate disasters, which is important. We should also be paying adaptation in order to help restore the environment, and including forests and degraded lands as part of our strategy. And that needs to be thought of. So I think a blending of adaptation, mitigation, restoration, and protection is all important.
Go back to the carbon market. The Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Market announced its plan for setting new global threshold standards for carbon credit in 2022 following a public consultation opening in May. What do you think of this initiative?
Well, I think any initiative to promote carbon markets is really important. However, I don't think that voluntary initiatives on their own can do the trick. They're important, and they are an important signal, but what they need to be followed up with is actual action and actual policies. The number one obstacle to preventing countries, all countries, but particularly major economies, from making a quick transition to a low-carbon, net-zero carbon emission economy is the underpricing of fossil fuels. And this involves both subsidies to producers and consumers that still exist that encourage more use of fossil fuels, and the failure to price carbon for the damages it causes, whether it's pollution that harms local people through death and mortality, whether it's climate change damages, or whether it's lost revenues from the underpricing. We need carbon prices in all economies to be brought in to help us have this transition to halving emissions by 2030 and then going on to have net carbon zero emissions by 2050. We cannot do that without some form of ending subsidies and imposing some form of carbon pricing, either through taxes or tradable permits.
In carbon pricing, is there any loophole? Because you notice that for Africa it's quite low, and for other countries, for instance, in your country, in the US, you recently said during an interview with Express Views that there is a carbon pricing, there is no carbon pricing in the US because of investors' interest and lobby on nature. Tell me.
Well, in the U.S., there are there is absolutely no carbon price at the national level. There are carbon prices at various states and regionally, locally. The problem is that without carbon pricing in the United States, the U.S. is not going to, I don't think, achieve its climate objectives, and particularly both what it wants to achieve in terms of reducing emissions with regard to the 2015 Paris Accord, and certainly not achieving what we would like to see, which is net zero carbon emissions by 2050. So clearly in the United States, there's a problem of tackling underpricing of fossil fuels. I have always argued that it's very different, the strategy that we should take in major economies such as the United States or European economies or G20 economies is it would be different for them as opposed to what one would expect in developing countries. In emerging market and developing countries, we must be aware of the fact that any transition to a low carbon economy must be compatible with the other objectives, which is reducing poverty and improving inclusivity. And so the type of policies which you want to see in poorer countries, such as in Africa, is indeed removing the underpricing, the subsidies of fossil fuels. But one has to introduce that carefully, and then also one has to think of what do you do with the savings that come from removing subsidies. One of the things I suggest is that, and others have suggested, is that you take the money that would be put into subsidies for production and consumption of fossil fuels and invest it instead in expanding renewable energy in remote areas, in areas where people do not have access to electricity or other energy sources, and they're forced to use local biomass and other and very poor quality fossil fuels, such as kerosene. So there are programs, for example, in India and Bangladesh, which are solar net safety nets, which are basically solar power safety nets, which are basically where pilot programs are experimenting with providing solar to remote rural households that don't have access to electricity. And if we took away fossil fuel subsidies and instead put them towards financing these types of programs, we would do two things. We would increase access to electricity to the poor, we'd improve the livelihoods of the poor, and we would also increase the use of renewables and reduce fossil fuels.
I see. Thank you. Go back to your book. What is actually the subject of this book, Economic for Fragile Planet? What is the meaning and what is actually the main goals of this book? Because you actually wrote many books, and about 25, I think, and many articles. So maybe this book is special.
What I tried to do in this book is to argue the case that in the next 10 years, to 20 years, we have an enormous environmental challenge, which is the rise in global environmental risks. There are five of them. Climate change, the loss of land use and biodiversity, freshwater scarcity, deterioration of oceans and coasts, and these type of impacts are felt around the world and at all levels, local, national, and globally. We need to rethink how we use economics to address this, and I think that we can tackle these problems by rethinking our markets, institutions, and governments based on five principles: ending the underpricing of nature, collective action, inclusivity, sustainability, and also just simply rethinking our institutions. And so what we need to do what I try to do in this book is explain what are the policies and what are the steps we need to do to apply these principles in order to tackle each of these problems and why that's necessary to do that in the next 10 to 20 years. So in a sense, yes, it's a kind of a culmination of the work I've been doing over the last 20, 30 years, arguing the cases for a new strategy in using economics to deal with these problems. And the two major problems I see is the underpricing of nature, and the other is the underfunding of nature investments. And until we do that, we're not going to tackle the major global environmental risks that our economies are facing.
And if actually your book should be introduced to the global south, to the global north, what would be the difference, what would be the approach that you will have to these people?
The approach I have is very similar to what I said earlier, which is that we have to recognize that if we are going to tackle the problem of global environmental risks, what we recommend as policies for major and advanced economies is different than what we would ask emerging market and developing countries to do. In emerging market and developing countries, any greening of their economies must be compatible with their immediate concerns about economic development and poverty alleviation. Hence, we have to think of policies that would be workable, that have been proven, and that have can have significant benefits, particularly to local people and to improving the livelihoods of as many people as possible. And I think that is a reasonable expectation, and I suggest policies that could be done. And some I've already discussed, such as using local people and traditionals' knowledge and institutions in managing forests. Programs such as subsidy swaps, moving subsidies from fossil fuels to supporting the expansion on renewable areas to the energy poor who don't have access to electricity. The other would be using a carbon tax to fund nature-based solutions, so, which has been proven in Costa Rica and Colombia to work, which is that a carbon tax, some of the proceeds is used to actually fund investments in nature in the country. And both Costa Rica has been doing this since 1997, and Colombia has adopted a similar policy in 2016. Both have been effective, and they have led to an increase in investments in nature-based solutions, working with local people. So there are a number of strategies that are in this book that are targeted to the needs of the various economies, depending on their level of development. And that's where collective action comes in. Collective action is the recognition that there is no one size that fits all, but all countries have to cooperate in order to ensure that we deal with these global environmental risks.
I see. Thank you very much, Mr. Barbier.
I really appreciate it.